York. This is Democracy Now!
As we tried to make clear in court today, what happened to Mahmoud Khalil is nothing short of extraordinary and shocking and outrageous. It should outrage anybody who believes that speech should be free in the United States of America.
Columbia University protest leader Mahmoud Khalil remains in immigration detention for a sixth day after being taken by ICE agents from his university housing. His green card has been revoked. He could be deported for speaking out against Israel's war on Gaza. We'll talk to his attorney. This comes as a group of UN experts has accused Israel of acts of genocide in Gaza by intentionally attacking and destroying maternity hospitals and Gaza's main fertility center. We'll go to Gaza to speak with two doctors, then to Washington, D.C., to speak with a former education official about the gutting of the U.S. Department of Education. Plus, we talked to an organizer of the Tesla takedown movement who's been personally targeted by Elon Musk. This comes as President Trump says he considers attacks on Tesla dealerships to be domestic terrorism.
Let me tell you, you do it to Tesla and you do it to any company, we're going to catch you and you're going to go through hell.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has extended an order blocking the deportation of detained Palestinian rights activist, recent Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil. He's a U.S. permanent resident who was arrested for leading Gaza solidarity protests at Columbia last year. His legal team spoke after a hearing in front of a Manhattan courthouse Wednesday. This is Bahar Azmi of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Mr. Khalil's detention has nothing to do with security. It is only about repression. The United States government has taken the position that it can arrest, detain, and seek to deport a lawful permanent resident exclusively because of his peaceful, constitutionally protected activism. In this case, activism in support of Palestinian human rights and an end to the genocide in Gaza.
Mahmoud Khalil was finally able to speak privately with his legal team on Wednesday following an order by the New York court to Homeland Security. Mahmoud Khalil's wife, who's a U.S. citizen and 8 months pregnant, issued a statement on Tuesday, quote, pleading with the world to continue to speak up against his unjust and horrific detention by the Trump administration, unquote. Protests have erupted across the country following Khalil's arrest Saturday, including in front of the ICE detention center in Louisiana, where he's being held. We'll have the latest on his case with one of Mahmoud Khalil's attorneys, Ramzi Qasem, after headlines. A panel of UN experts has accused Israel of genocidal acts against Palestinians in Gaza through attacks on women's health care facilities, deliberately blocking medicine for pregnancies and neonatal care, and using sexual violence as a war strategy. In a new report, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory writes, quote, Israeli authorities have destroyed in part the reproductive capacity of the Palestinians in Gaza as a group, including by imposing measures intended to prevent births, one of the categories of genocidal acts in the Rome Statute and the Genocide Convention, unquote. The commission also documented the use of forced public stripping and nudity, sexual harassment, including threats of rape, as well as sexual assault as part of Israeli forces' standard operating procedure. Mediated talks between Israel and Hamas continue today in Doha as Palestinians in Gaza endured a 12th straight day of Israel's total blockade of the Palestinian territory. We'll go to Gaza to speak with two doctors who are working there. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced it's undertaking the largest deregulation action in U.S. history. This includes rolling back dozens of crucial water, air quality and industry measures, as well as defunding billions of dollars from green energy and local climate groups. At threat is the landmark endangerment finding, which classifies greenhouse gases as a public health threat and allows for climate regulations. This is EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin.
I've been told the endangerment finding is considered the holy grail of the climate change religion. For me, the U.S. Constitution and the laws of this nation will be strictly interpreted and followed. No exceptions. Today, the Green New scam ends.
The head of Sunrise Movement called the EPA's move, quote, an FU to anyone who wants to breathe clean air, drink clean water, or live past 2030, unquote. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is bracing for another round of mass firings after the Trump administration signaled plans to lay off more than 1,000 workers. NOAA's workforce is already down by about 2,000 people since Trump took office following a first round of cuts and a buyout offer by Elon Musk and his Doge operation. The Trump administration has begun gutting the Justice Department unit that oversees prosecutions of public officials accused of corruption. Cuts to the public integrity section come after several of its officials resigned last month when Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bovee ordered them to drop federal corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Meanwhile, the acting commissioner of the Social Security Administration, Leland Dudek, has privately said Social Security benefits are in a far more precarious place than has been widely understood. In a recording obtained by ProPublica, he framed the administration's planned cuts of at least 7,000 Social Security workers as the president's agenda. On Wednesday, Democratic Congressmember John Larson lashed out at Elon Musk and his Republican colleagues during a Social Security subcommittee meeting.
If he's so great, if these plans and all the fraud and abuse that he found are so evident, why isn't he here explaining it? You know why. Because he's out to privatize Social Security. He's been on television the last couple of days talking exactly about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and what he intends to do. Privatize it. The American people, some of them may have been born at night, but not last night.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ordered the Trump administration to pay nearly $2 billion in foreign aid funds owed to grant recipients and contractors of the State Department, the U.S. Agency for International Development. In Monday's ruling, U.S. District Judge Amir Ali said the administration's freeze on the foreign aid funds likely violates the separation of powers, writing, quote, the constitutional power over whether to spend foreign aid is not the president's own, and it is Congress's own. Unquote. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's ordered the wholesale destruction of classified documents and other records at USAID, which President Trump and Elon Musk are working to dismantle. An email from USAID's acting executive secretary, Erica Carr, reads, quote, shred as many documents first and reserve the burn bags for when the shredder becomes unavailable or needs a break, unquote. It's not clear whether any USAID official got permission from the National Archives to destroy the documents, a necessary step under the Federal Records Act of 1950. The Trump administration's flown all 40 remaining immigrants from the Guantanamo Bay military prison back to the U.S., to Louisiana. The move follows a congressional delegation's visit to Guantanamo over the weekend, and amidst mounting legal challenges, nearly 300 immigrants have been locked up by the Trump administration at Guantanamo. Russia continued attacks on multiple Ukrainian cities overnight. In Kherson, a 42-year-old woman was killed by Russian artillery fire. Meanwhile, Russia's top general says his forces have reclaimed nearly 90% of the territory Ukraine seized from Russia's Kursk border region during a surprise counteroffensive in August. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin toured a command post near the front lines in Kursk, dressed in military fatigues. Russian forces made rapid gains in recent days after the Trump administration cut off intelligence sharing and the flow of weapons to Ukraine. The administration restored the assistance on Tuesday after Ukraine agreed to a 30-day ceasefire proposal. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, arrived in Moscow earlier today for talks at the Kremlin over the ceasefire plan. Reuters reports Russia presented the U.S. with a list of demands similar to its previous ultimatums. No NATO membership for Ukraine, an agreement not to deploy foreign troops in Ukraine, and international recognition of Putin's claim to Crimea and for Ukrainian provinces. Meanwhile, Poland's president has repeated his request for the U.S. to deploy nuclear weapons on Polish soil, calling it a deterrent to Russian aggression. As Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs went into effect Wednesday, Canada imposed its own 25% retaliatory tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as on computers, sports equipment, and other goods, totaling over $20 billion. This is on top of previously announced reciprocal tariffs on U.S. goods. This is Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly.
Canada is not the one driving up the cost of your groceries or of your gasoline or any of your construction. Canada is not the one putting your jobs at risk. Canada is not the one that is ultimately starting this war. President Trump's tariffs against you are causing that. And there are no winners in a trade war.
As the trade war between Trump and Canada escalates, the U.S. has paused talks with Ottawa on a key water-sharing treaty over the Columbia River. Trump's repeatedly called for the U.S. annexation of Canada, for Canada to become the 51st state. In Greenland, the opposition center-right Demokratiet Party pulled off a surprise victory in parliamentary elections. All of Greenland's main parties have called for full independence from Denmark, though the Demokratiet Party favors a more gradual transition. The election was called last month as Greenland came under a major international spotlight amidst Trump's threats to take over the territory, which is home to rare earth minerals. Greenlanders have forcefully rejected the idea. The population of Greenland is just 56,000 and is 90% Inuit. Uganda's deployed special forces to South Sudan amidst escalating tensions between South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar over a collapsing power-sharing deal. The 2018 agreement ended a five-year civil war that killed some 400,000 people. Deadly clashes by armed groups have been mounting, many centered in Upper Nile State. The UN has urged South Sudan's leaders, quote, to resolve tensions through dialogue. And Yale has suspended an international law scholar and outspoken defender of Palestinian rights after an AI-powered far-right website called Jewish Onliner accused her of ties to a group on U.S. sanctions list, an apparent reference to the advocacy organization Samidun. Helia Daturi wrote in a statement, quote, Yale Law School actions constitute a blatant act of retaliation against Palestinian solidarity. I am being targeted for one reason alone, for speaking the truth about the genocide of the Palestinian people that Yale University is complicit, she said. She added, the move from Yale is, quote, the last refuge of a crumbling order, an empire in decline, resorting to brute repression to stifle and crush those who expose its unraveling hegemony. Unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we go to Gaza and also get an update on the Columbia University recent graduate student who is being held in ICE detention, despite the fact that, well, he has or had a green card. His wife is 8 months pregnant. Stay with us. What to Do With Myself, performed by Tim Maia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has released a report that Israel carried out genocidal acts by systematically attacking and destroying sexual and reproductive health care facilities in Gaza, including a fertility center, maternity wards, maternity hospitals, and preventing access to necessary medicines and equipment to ensure safe pregnancies, deliveries, and neonatal care. The Geneva-based Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel, said, quote, Israeli authorities have destroyed in part the reproductive capacity of the Palestinians in Gaza as a group, including by imposing measures intended to prevent births, unquote. The report describes Israel's shelling of the Al-Basma IVF Center in Gaza City in December 2023 that destroyed 4,000 embryos as intentional and, quote, a measure intended to prevent births among Palestinians in Gaza, which is a genocidal act under the Rome Statute and the Genocide Convention, unquote. Describing the harm to pregnant, lactating, and new mothers as unprecedented, the commission said Israeli security forces, quote, deliberately inflicted conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza as a group, one of the categories of genocidal acts in the Rome Statute and the Genocide Convention, unquote. The UN report also accuses Israel's security forces of using forced public stripping and sexual assault as part of their standard operating procedures to punish Palestinians since the beginning of the war. Israel's permanent mission to the UN in Geneva rejected the allegations, and the report is unfounded and biased. For more on the attack on Gaza's fragile healthcare system, and as Israel's total blockade of the Gaza Strip enters its 12th day with no food, medicine, or fuel allowed in, we go now to Gaza, where we're joined by two volunteer doctors. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is a trauma surgeon volunteering at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, Gaza, with MedGlobal. He is usually based in California. And Dr. Mark Perlmutter is an orthopedics hand surgery specialist volunteering also at Nasser Medical Complex with the charity Humanity Auxilium. Last year, they both volunteered at the European hospital in Khan Yunis during Israel's active assault on Gaza. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Feroz Sidwa, let's begin with you. You've just heard this breaking news of the UN report calling Israel guilty of genocidal acts, particularly targeting maternity hospitals, the IVF clinic, and overall the healthcare system in Gaza. If you can respond to coming back to Gaza now, how you found the hospital and your response to what they found.
Yes, the hospital in Gaza is, we're at Nasser Medical Complex on the western side of Khan Yunis, and it's certainly better than when we were at European Hospital last year. The whole hospital isn't full of refugees and displaced people. The hospital can actually function. But this hospital was actually attacked in February and March of last year. Dialysis ward was destroyed. A lot of equipment for new operating rooms was destroyed. And right now, the blockade is really affecting the availability of instruments and disposables in the operating room. And it's making life very difficult for people here. You know, beyond the healthcare system, the prices in the market are going up again. The availability of certain types of food is going down. Meat and other proteins are very hard to come by now. Eggs are about a dollar a piece in the market just outside the hospital that I saw yesterday. So it's a very difficult situation. And the attacks on the healthcare system that were done in the past 16 months have really undermined its ability to help people.
And can you talk about the Israeli energy minister just cutting off electricity to Gaza?
It hasn't been an obvious problem in the hospital because we have a generator, but the electricity is now clicking on and off, I don't know, three times a day, four times a day, whereas before it was not doing that. It's cutting off electricity to a whole population captive in an open air prison is going to have.
It looks like we just lost the video to Gaza, to Khan Yunis. It's remarkable that we're even able to make that connection as we talk about electricity being cut off. While we try to regain that connection and talk with the two doctors who've just returned to Gaza, we're going to go to news here at home, which is clearly directly connected, and that is Mahmoud Khalil, the recent Columbia University graduate Palestine activist detained by the Trump administration last week. Khalil, who is a Palestinian green card holder, has finally been able to speak to his lawyers after a federal judge on Wednesday ordered the Department of Homeland Security to allow him to have private calls with his legal team. Prior to this, Khalil had been unable to speak to his lawyers since his arrest on Saturday night, except for a brief call Monday to confirm he'd been transferred to a detention facility in Jena, Louisiana, where he is still being held. At a hearing on Wednesday here in New York's Manhattan Federal Court, U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman, who temporarily blocked Khalil's deportation earlier this week, extended his order while he considers whether Khalil's arrest was unconstitutional. The government's charging document says the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has determined that Khalil's presence or activities in the United States would have, quote, serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States, unquote. Outside the courthouse, Khalil's lawyer, Ramzi Qasem, told reporters what's happening to Mahmoud Khalil is shocking and outrageous.
It is absolutely unprecedented. The grounds that are being cited by the government for purportedly claiming to revoke his green card and putting him in removal proceedings. This is a person who is a lawful permanent resident. This is a U.S. person. Those grounds are vague. They are rarely used. Essentially, they are a form of punishment and retaliation for the exercise of free speech.
The Trump administration's accused Khalil, without evidence, of being a so-called terrorist sympathizer for participating in Palestinian solidarity protests at Columbia University. In a social media post, President Trump celebrated Khalil's arrest, saying it was the first of many to come. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters Wednesday, this is not about free speech. Rubio added, quote, this is about people who don't have a right to be in the United States to begin with, end quote. In her first media interview, Mahmoud Khalil's wife, Noor Abdallah, who is 8 months pregnant, who is a U.S. citizen, told Reuters she had been naive to think Khalil was safe from arrest as a permanent legal resident. She added, no one from Columbia University's administration had contacted her to offer help, although Mahmoud had written to the president of Columbia University a few days before he was arrested, expressing concern and fear and asking for some kind of protection. He was arrested by ICE agents in his Columbia housing. For more on Mahmoud Khalil's legal case, we're joined now by his lawyer, Ramzi Qasem, professor of law at CUNY, that's the City University of New York, where he founded the legal clinic CLEAR. The acronym stands for Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. Ramzi, thank you for joining us again. You were just in court yesterday. Explain what the judge ruled.
Thank you, Amy. Yesterday was an important day in court. As you mentioned, the judge has prohibited the government from deporting Khalil until further order of the court. So that's important. The judge also agreed with us, the lawyers for Khalil, that it was imperative for the government to respond to our motion to bring Khalil back to New York. And so the government has to respond to that motion by tomorrow. And the government also last night moved to change venue, meaning that the government believes Khalil's habeas corpus case, the case that he brought in federal court, should not be in federal court in New York, but it should be in federal court in Louisiana. And we, you know, that's not really a surprise to us, because, of course, it's been very clear from the beginning that the government's strategy is to cut Khalil off, not just from access to the court here in New York, not just from access to his legal team, but from access to his support base, to his community, to his family, including his expecting wife. And that's the only conceivable reason why the government would not have held him in New York or New Jersey, as they typically do, and move him 1,000 miles away merely hours after he files a lawsuit in federal court challenging the constitutionality of his detention.
Now, Ranzi Qasem, were you able to speak with Mahmoud yesterday after the judge's ruling?
Yeah, Amy, we were. So when we were in court yesterday, we asked the judge to order the government to allow us to have a privileged conversation with our client in Louisiana. Since we brought suit on his behalf and filed the motion to have him brought back home to New York City, we haven't been able to speak to him. One of the lawyers on the team was able to have an unprivileged call, but as most of your listeners and viewers know, those calls, the unprivileged calls, the regular calls and visits can be monitored or recorded by the government. So the judge ordered the government to allow us to have a privileged conversation. We had the first privileged conversation with Mahmoud last night. Of course, I'm limited in what I can say about that privileged conversation, but I can tell you that thankfully he is in good spirits. He's in fighting spirits. He appreciates all the support that he's received. The fact that there were thousands of people, certainly hundreds, I would say over 1,000 people outside the courthouse yesterday, masked to protest in solidarity with him and in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
The government is trying to deport Mahmoud based on a rarely used provision of federal immigration law that allows the Secretary of State to remove individuals whose presence it believes has potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States, unquote. Can you explain this extremely rare provision? The only previous time it was used before was in 1995, according to recent press reports. According to the New York Times, that was an attempt to deport a former Mexican government official. Ironically, the judge who struck it down as unconstitutional in 1996 was Marianne Trump Barry, President Trump's sister, who was a federal judge in New Jersey. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, so that provision has, an interesting history, to say the least. It's a provision that is now understood to have been enacted primarily to target Eastern European Jewish Holocaust survivors who came to the United States and were suspected, often wrongly suspected, of being Soviet agents. So that's the origin story of this particular piece of federal legislation. And that origin story is the reason why Congress came back in and amended it, saying, well, you can't use this law to punish people for their views and their speech. And if you want to do that, then it requires a personal certification by the Secretary of State for why that person's presence and their speech poses a compelling risk to U.S. foreign policy interests. And it also requires the Secretary of State to notify Congress with supporting evidence for why they're making this move. So it is an exceedingly rarely used provision, and it certainly does not trump the Constitution and Mr. Khalil's First Amendment rights.
So what are you calling for now as we wrap up?
Well, we're calling for what we've always called for and what Mahmoud and his family and his supporters and their supporters have always called for. Any day Mahmoud spends in detention, whether it's in Louisiana or elsewhere, is a day too long. We want to bring him back to New York. We want to bring him back to his family. And so we want him moved back here and freed as soon as possible. And we're pursuing that through every available avenue, with the support of hundreds of thousands of people. This idea that the movement in support of Palestinian lives and dignity, that criticism of U.S. foreign policy in Palestine and support for Israel is this fringe movement that is driven by foreign actors is a falsehood. Of course, there are non-citizens and green card holders like Khalil involved in the movement, but this is an American movement, and the government is in denial about that, and that's going to backfire possibly in court, but definitely in the court of public opinion.
As we wrap up, Ranzi Qasem, you're also an expert on Guantanamo. It is very interesting that in our headlines, we just reported that the Trump administration has just removed the migrants it sent to Guantanamo and sent them to Louisiana, the state that Mahmoud is also in.
And you know, this is just one example, right, of this administration overreaching and having to back off because of the intense backlash through organizing, through legal means in the media. And we hope that the same will happen in Mahmoud's case soon.
Ramzi Kassam, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of law at City University of New York. That's CUNY Law School. He founded and co-directs CLEAR, a legal clinic. CLEAR joined with the Center for Constitutional Rights to file a federal habeas petition in the Southern District of New York challenging Mahmoud Khalil's detention. We'll keep you updated. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We just reconnected with Gaza. We'll see how long we can keep them on. To return to our conversation with two American doctors who are volunteering at hospitals in Khan Yunis. This is now the 12th day since Israel's completely blockaded the Strip, cutting off all food, medicine and fuel. Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter, welcome back to Democracy Now! Dr. Perlmutter, we last spoke to you in North Carolina. After you had returned from Gaza, you are back. Can you talk about what's happening and particularly about the medical staff, the doctors, the nurses, the staff, those, for example, who have been arrested by Israel, even one, I understand, who you've talked to, who was recently released?
I have a colleague, an orthopedic surgeon, specializes in pediatric orthopedics, who was abducted from the hospital, from the operating room in February of 2024. He was just released. When he was arrested, he was strip searched, marched naked in front of his colleagues, beaten on a daily basis in an Israeli prison, beaten more intensely when he asked to speak to a lawyer, and even more intensely after he spoke to his lawyer. He had his fingers broken in his hand. He had, while handcuffs on, guards step on the handcuffs to torque them into the nerves of his hand, ruining the nerves in his operative hands. And if the physical daily beatings and the loss of his hand function wasn't enough, the psychologic torture, which is their specialty, according to almost everybody who's been released, and there's still approximately 350 healthcare workers in Israeli prisons, all without charges. The psychologic torture is immense. They showed him photographs, surveillance photographs of his wife, and said, "We will bring her here and gang rape her in front of you if you don't admit that you're Hamas," which is what their request was when they were breaking individual finger bones. And then they showed him a GPS photo of his house and said that they would send a drone through his bedroom window, killing his wife and kids if he did admit that he was Hamas. So the physical and mental torture, which is supported by many healthcare workers that were released and is still obviously going on in Israeli prisons, presents a tremendous weight on the healthcare system here.
Dr. Mark Perlmutter, you are a Jewish American. You are urging him, this orthopedic surgeon, to sue American Israeli, you know, American IDF soldiers in a civil suit, making them personally, financially responsible for what has taken place. Again, you are also currently president of the World Surgical Foundation, immediate past president of the International College of Surgeons. A civil lawsuit?
Well, it's something that's developing now. You know, we've all been to D.C. and spoke to our feckless senators and congressmen. We find them, I personally find them to be spineless and, along with our past two presidents, directly responsible for the carnage that we've witnessed here. I think soon that American 2,000-pound bombs will be dropping here again when the ceasefire ends, and Israel has ruined every ceasefire that has ever been declared in their history with Palestine. And I think that when that that carnage restarts decades from now, history will remember, especially our past two presidents and our current spineless Senate and Congress, as the murderers that they truly are by not having the guts to stand up to Israel. And it's not an anti-Jewish stance. It's an anti-Zionism stance that they need to take. And every time somebody protests in favor of a Palestinian, just like this story that that you just broadcast, it's interpreted as an anti-Semitic stance and not an anti-Zionism stance. And the two are completely different. In fact, Zionism is the major cause for the destruction of Judaism.
Dr. Feroz Sidwa, you recently met with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to ask about raising Dr. Abu Safia, the head of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, the pediatric hospital, his detention. He's been taken prisoner by Israel. I believe we just lost our two doctors in Gaza. We're going to break, see if we can get them back. But if not, we're going to go to Washington, D.C. to talk about the gutting of the Department of Education. We've been speaking with Dr. Mark Perlmutter and Dr. Feroz Sidwa, two U.S.-based surgeons currently volunteering at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Last year, they volunteered at European Hospital during Israel's active assault on Gaza. Stay with us.
Haram, haram.
Visit performed by Dorsat Hamdani. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We've still lost touch with Gaza. We'll see if we can get the two American doctors back who are volunteering there. We turn now, though, to look at two stories at the U.S. Department of Education. On Monday, Education Secretary Linda McMahon issued a warning to 60 universities that they're being investigated for anti-Semitism on their campuses and could face penalties. Her warning came days after the Trump administration withdrew $400 million in federal grants and contracts to Columbia University. This comes as Linda McMahon is moving ahead with plans to gut her own agency. On Tuesday, plans were announced to fire an additional 1,300 workers, effectively cutting the agency's workforce in half since Trump took office. We're joined now by Tarek Habash, who served as a policy advisor in the Department of Education's Office of Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development until he resigned 14 months ago to protest President Biden's support of Israel's war on Gaza. He was the Education Department's only Palestinian-American appointee. He's co-founder and director of A New Policy, a lobbying group focused on U.S. policy towards Israel and Palestine. So, Tarek Habash, we brought you on to talk about two issues. One is what Linda McMahon, the new education secretary, has just announced, warning 60 universities, equating anti-Semitism with the pro-Palestinian protests on campus, where many of those who are protesting are Jewish students, and then also the gutting of the department, what it means. Why don't you start with the warning?
Thank you so much for having me back, Amy. I think it's pretty clear what this administration is trying to do, and it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, unfortunately. It has everything to do with Donald Trump's vision for America, which is consolidating his authoritarian power and pressuring any political dissidents who disagree with his policies and his approach, and leveraging our civil rights laws and our institutions to be able to repress any sort of dissent and active speech on college campuses or across the country. And unfortunately, this isn't something that is just happening under Donald Trump, but this was longstanding under the Biden administration and one of the reasons that I left. Unfortunately, this idea that student protests in solidarity with Palestinian rights, this idea that anti-war protesters are somehow, hateful or discriminating against their peers, particularly when Jewish students are disproportionately represented in these protests, is really concerning. And Trump is escalating that threat against college campuses right now through the announcement that you said Linda McMahon made, 60 colleges now essentially being put on notice for investigations. The problem with that is also that we are simultaneously seeing the Department of Education get gutted. And a huge part of the gutting that is happening just a couple days ago is specifically targeting the Office for Civil Rights and all of the experts and lawyers that are in charge and tasked with doing the investigations that take a pretty substantial amount of time to do. What is happening here is not real investigations into actual discrimination. This is a political ploy. This is the weaponization of our institutions, and it's extremely dangerous. And colleges have an obligation to stand up and protect not only their students and faculty, but our democratic institutions as we know them.
And so what does it mean to, I mean, it's clear from Project 2025, what President Trump has said, and Linda McMahon even, that they're actually trying to just shut down the Department of Education. But to lose half its staff, what this means, they say, just give money to the states. There's no, the Department of Education is just a bureaucracy.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is patently illegal for Donald Trump and the executive branch to just eliminate a federal agency. And they know that, which is why they're doing the next best thing in their eyes, although still illegal, is completely gutting the entire civil service and workforce without any rationale or reason for that to happen. The Department of Education does numerous things that they can't just, you know, wave away with money to states and money to schools and that be the end of it. There's a lot of oversight. There's a lot of security. There's a lot of student privacy and data and information that the department is responsible and obligated to protect. And when you gut the people that are doing that day-to-day work, when you're gutting the people who are doing the program compliance to make sure that schools are following the rules and protecting their students and providing equal opportunity for education, it creates a really, really dangerous circumstance where money is not going where it needs to go and people are misusing the money. And when you talk about that in the context of what DOGE is supposed to be doing, this idea of government and government efficiency and ending waste, fraud, and abuse, this is the exact opposite. The Department of Education is the smallest cabinet agency. They had just over, 4,200 employees just a few months ago. This is not a bloated institution. This is an institution that is working for the American people and some of our most vulnerable, our students, our disabled students, our students who are international, who are here to study and to learn, to be able to contribute to society, to serve their communities. And it's horrifying to see that the Trump administration doesn't value any of that. And the reality is they don't value education. They value what they can use the Department of Education for, which is turning it into a propaganda machine, a political tool to be able to consolidate Donald Trump's power.
Well, Tarek Abbas, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and director of a new policy lobbying organization focused on U.S. policy towards Israel and Palestine. He's a former Department of Education official who resigned in response to President Biden's support of Israel's war on Gaza, was the department's only Palestinian-American appointee. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We just reconnected with Gaza and want to return to our conversation with the two doctors who are volunteering at hospitals in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Now the 12th day since Israel's completely blockaded the strip, cutting off all food, medicine and fuel. Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter are back with us. Dr. Feroz Sidwa, I was just asking you about your meeting with the it looks like we may have just lost them. We're going to see if they can hear us still. We're hoping we're able to do this. But I think we're going to have to go to our last segment. And if we're able to get them back, we will. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Elon Musk targeted me over Tesla protests. That proves our movement is working. That's a new article a headline of a new article in The Guardian by our next guest, who's been helping to organize the Tesla takedown protests at Tesla showrooms to protest Elon Musk, President Trump's billionaire advisor, the richest man in the world, and his top campaign donor. While Musk has been helping to dismantle numerous government agencies, or leading the charge to dismantle them, stock prices for his company, Tesla, have fallen so much that President Trump felt compelled this week to announce he'll personally buy a Tesla. On Tuesday, Trump and Musk held what's compared to an infomercial for Tesla outside the White House. During the event, Trump told a reporter that he considers attacks on Tesla dealerships to be domestic terrorism.
Mr. President talks about some of the violence that's been going on around the country at dealerships. Some say they should be labeled domestic terrorists.
I will do that. We got a lot of cameras up. We already know who some of them are. We're going to catch them. And they're bad guys. Let me tell you, you do it to Tesla and you do it to any company, we're going to catch you and you're going to go through hell.
We're joined now by Valerie Costa, a Seattle-based activist who's helping to organize the Tesla takedown movement with the local group Troublemakers and others. Valerie, can you talk about Elon Musk singling you out? And what are you doing in organizing, what is your goal, these protests around the country from Washington State, Seattle, where you are, to here in New York, the Tesla dealership here?
Yeah. Hi. So this past weekend, I woke up first Saturday to a tweet where Elon Musk had tweeted that Troublemakers, the group I organize with, along with four other organizations, were Act Blue funded, which is, at least for Troublemakers, is outright not true. And then Sunday morning, I received a friend sent me the most chilling text for me, which was Elon Musk had retweeted another tweet where this person had taken a clip from a podcast interview I did about the Tesla takedown protests and made allegations that I was promoting vandalism and such. And Musk said, Costa is committing crimes. So that was terrifying to receive the news of that tweet. And the fallout from that has just been, there's been a lot of people online trying to smear me, make connections, make up stories about who I am and where I get money from, all sorts of just harassment. And I've received threats. It's been scary. In response to a tweet from a person who essentially bought his way into the White House as the largest online and social media platform and is spreading outright lies about me and the movement as a whole, the Tesla takedown movement as a whole. So I'm just an organizer with the Seattle-based group Troublemakers. There's a group of us here. We're working with a number of organizations and individuals who've been planning protests at Tesla showrooms in the area for the last month or so. They're peaceful, nonviolent protests. They're First Amendment protected, free speech, peaceful assembly. And we've done that and we'll continue to do that as this movement is gaining momentum.
Can you talk about the fake buyers, actions at Tesla dealerships where there have been reports of protesters faking interest in buying a Tesla to waste time?
I'm not sure. I know that people are, using different strategies and tactics to engage with Tesla. But I can't speak to that particular strategy that mm-hmm. people are using. I think there's different tools in the, protesters' toolbox. I mean, essentially protesting Tesla, this protest is ultimately about hitting Elon Musk's bottom line. Every dollar that goes into Tesla, every Tesla that's purchased, increases essentially his profits. And the more money he has, it's clear the more influence he has in the government and in the world. He was able to, like I said, buy his way into the White House with his $250 million contribution to Donald Trump's campaign. And he bought Twitter. giving himself sort of a platform to spread lies. And this campaign is giving people a way to show their outrage about what he's doing to dismantle critical services and government institutions that people rely on for their health and well-being in this country.
And can you talk about the strategy of Tesla takedown, urging people to dump Tesla stock?
I think it's just related to what I just said. It's really about, you know, you as a consumer, you as a person that may have stocks and investments, you can choose where to put your money. And I think right now, given the essentially fascist takeover of our government, one thing that you can easily do is to move your money out of Tesla into other companies, into other things in your community. You can move it out of the market where your money will be used for better, for good.
And can you address Elon Musk's claims about violence at Tesla dealerships? You're in Seattle, where on Sunday someone set fire to four Tesla Cybertrucks in a Tesla lot in Seattle's industrial district.
For sure, there's been vandalism at Tesla dealerships. I've seen it on the news. I want to make it really clear that I don't, and the Tesla takedown movement, troublemakers, none of us have ever supported violence or called for violence. We do not believe in that as a strategy of nonviolent resistance. I think the vandalism really shows the outright anger and rage that people are feeling about what Elon Musk is doing right now in our government.
Clearly, the movement has had an effect. Even a Fox reporter questioning Elon Musk and President Trump at that infomercial at the White House, where you could see President Trump had a piece of paper that talked about the costs of various Tesla cars, you know, over $100,000. And he asked about pushing these expensive cars at a time when so many people are suffering in the United States. I was wondering if you could respond to that. Now, that was a Fox reporter asking that question. But also,
it's wild.
Also, Elon Musk talking about violence at dealerships as domestic terrorism.
Yeah, I'll first speak to the first part. I mean, that infomercial on the White House lawn was surreal. I've been an activist in different forms for years, and I've never been part of something like this that's gained such quick momentum and sort of gotten such national attention. For better or worse. And you can really tell with, you know, the president of the United States of America is buying a car from the world's richest man's company. Why? In order to make him feel better, in order to try to prop up the stock. I think the stock barely went up that day and it has only gone up a little since then. I think it really shows that this movement is working, that it's... you know, it's gained momentum. It's not just in the United States. We've, I think, had over 300 protests so far throughout the country that are known of, that have been put on the Tesla takedown map. There's 95 planned for this weekend. And that's all decentralized. Like, I'm just based in Seattle. I've just been involved in the Seattle-based protests. This is just, Tesla takedown is essentially a website with a map where you can put your protest on the map and encourage people in your community to show up and speak out and defend, you know, their civil liberties as well as, you know, their upset about what Elon Musk is doing. The allegations.
Valerie, we have 30 seconds.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. The allegations and the rhetoric right now of conflating the Tesla takedown protests with violence and domestic terrorism is chilling. But I think more than ever, this is a time that we all need to show up because our civil liberties are getting attacked, as we've seen throughout even just watching your program this morning. And I just encourage folks to step up, because the more of us who do, it'll be safer for all of us.
Valerie Costa, I want to thank you for being with us, an activist with the Tesla takedown movement, speaking to us from Seattle, Washington. We just reconnected with Gaza. We'll try to return to our conversation with the two doctors in Khan Yunis, Gaza. They are Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter. Dr. Sidwa, you're meeting with the U.N. Secretary General and demanding to know or pushing for information on where Dr. Abu Safia is, the head of the Kamel Adwan Pediatric Hospital.
Yes, Dr. Abu Safia was taken after Kamel Adwan had been laid siege to for 80 or 90 days. The entire hospital has been completely destroyed at this point. And, he's just a pediatrician, nothing special about him. He was actually taken by the Israelis earlier in the war and let go precisely because he's not a threat to anybody. But then they decided to arrest him again, decided to torment him as well, just like they have with so many others. But yes, we were able to meet with Antonio Gutierrez, the Secretary General of the UN, as well as Tom Fletcher, the Undersecretary General for OCHA. Secretary General Gutierrez was very interested in the case. He asked Mr. Fletcher to look into it, which he did. Mr. Fletcher raised the issue with the Israelis, met with Dr. Abu Safia's family quite publicly, actually. And still no word on Dr. Abu Safia's release date. The Israelis keep pushing back his court dates and things like that. But we're very much hoping that he'll be released soon. This territory needs every doctor, every nurse that it can possibly muster. It's true that the bombs have stopped falling and most of the shooting has stopped. The Israelis are still killing about half a dozen people a day. But the bombing has, thank God, stopped for the most part. But everyone here is still homeless. Everyone here is still hungry. Everyone here is still thirsty. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, the Israelis have cut off all entry and exit to Gaza again. You've got 1.8, 1.9, 2 million people locked in a cage, and they can't access anything from the outside world. They can't survive like this. People are turning on each other here. Palestinian society is very communal and very... There's a lot of solidarity in it, but there's limits to everything. Just last night, we actually had a mass shooting between two different families over what, who knows. But people are just at their breaking point with the necessities of life just being unavailable, not for a week or a month or a year, but for 16 months now. It has to end. And what the United States is doing about this is just shameful. It's backing Israel all the way. It's got to stop. It's got to stop.
And the complete cutting off of aid now into Gaza, which has been condemned by humanitarian groups around the world, Dr. Sidwa?
I'm here with Med Global. It's a group that brings doctors in. But even though I was able to get in, half of my own group was denied entry. So only two out of the five doctors that were scheduled to come are here now. Dr. Perlmutter, your hand surgery colleague was also denied entry. What is being allowed in and not being allowed in, who is being allowed in and not allowed in. It just seems to be completely random and arbitrary. And it's wreaking havoc on the whole society. I mean, again, the whole, people can't survive with nothing. That's not how human life works. And if the United States needs to stop backing this insane isolation of 2 million people, half of whom are children, most of whom are refugees, they didn't do anything to anybody. Just stop treating them this way.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter, both U.S.-based surgeons back in Gaza to volunteer. They're currently volunteering at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. To see the full interview, you can go to the beginning of our show as we lost connection with them repeatedly throughout the broadcast. And to see Dr. Sidwa's op-ed in The New York Times, we'll link to it at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.